thanks so much for being on this podcast, man. We appreciate you. We've been
wanting for asking.
Yeah, absolutely, man. We've been wanting to get you on for a while, and you're in LA right now, correct? Well, this guy's got his espresso cup.
Yeah.
You're so Italian, dude.
I don't think we're ready.
It's the best, dude.
I can't drink coffee. It gives me an anxiety attack.
It's an audio podcast, but he's in a tracksuit and he's sipping latte. So, or espresso. Sorry, espresso.
I am trying to live to the maximum level of comfort, but I am in Los Angeles, yes.
It's good. You've been out there for a little bit now.
Couple years now, yeah.
Couple years.
I've been actually trying to figure it out, and it sounds weird, but I'm trying to figure out if this March is my third year or my fourth year out here. So I really lost track of time. But
Jesus, wow.
I don't know. Yeah.
Do you have like a receipt or anything of like, you know?
There is, but the timelines are just weird. Like, it said that I got my green card in 2018. So you would assume that I've been here on my third year, you know, going into March. But there's weird timelines that don't add up, like Christmases that have passed, and my rent goes up every year, and I'm pretty sure it's gone up already three times. So that means it's going up the fourth time this year. So I'm like, it's just, let's just say three. I've been here for 3 years almost.
It's fair. That's fair.
You've got a really big dilemma on your hands, though, by the way.
This is
a real like stress. You have a whole year where you don't know what happened to you. You just like it.
Yeah.
That's a problem.
I lost
You lost the full year. But you've been busy.
I lost the full year. I've been trying to be busy. Yeah. I've been trying to, you know, do whatever you can do to keep busy, especially during these COVID times, you know.
Trying times. Yeah.
Trying times, you know. It's
a lot of people love saying that, these trying times, and it's just like, yeah, really, it's so offensive
just
to
people trying that, during these times.
It's so offensive to people that are actually going through something, and it's like,
yeah, exactly. And that's the thing where, you know, I will say one thing about COVID that I've noticed, not, I don't want to talk about it a lot because it's obviously the talk of the town, but it's really, I'm not seeing as much people complain about little things anymore, because I think like people just don't care. It's like, hey man, like, I don't care about your stupid problem. This is a national pandemic that's happening.
Yeah,
you know?
Sure.
Yeah, well, like, I think human beings, like, through any major thing that happens to us, like, we have a very short-term memory. Like, obviously, it's weird for me to bring this up as an Arab, but, like, 9-11, everybody made a fuss, you know, made a huge big deal about it. But then
you almost said made a fuss.
Made a fuss?
Yeah. A little fussy about 9/11.
Like, a little kerfuffle, you know?
Yeah. Ruffled some feathers, for sure.
Yeah, like, it rubbed a few elbows. But, and then within a few, like, you know, like, maybe, like, 4 months, everybody was like, hey, you know, airplanes are weird, right? And then just everybody was...
Yeah, it got back to complaining.
Yeah, you know, and that's the same thing with COVID. Yeah. Same thing with the COVID, like March and April was like a big deal for everyone. And as soon as like summer hit, and it was a really good summer here, especially in Canada.
Yeah,
at least like
I know
GTA. So everybody was like out and doing stuff. So you're right. Like people just tend to adjust easily, right?
Yeah, you got to adapt. Really, you're gonna just kind of get left behind.
Yeah, no, you gotta, yeah, exactly. Like, but I personally wanted to talk to you about a lot of things, but one first thing that I want to talk about is that you've posted at some point that you had a short film that made it into a festival. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was like actually something that, you know, we did at the beginning of lockdown. There was, when it was like in the heavy part of the lockdown where you're not allowed to leave pretty much, I had an idea for a short film that I was looking to do before COVID came into the picture, and I was just like kind of losing my mind. And then they had this isolation film festival that was like all COVID based stuff, and you had to do it within your apartment, follow, you know, safety procedures and all that. And I just kind of redid the script to work for being locked in an apartment. You know, I don't know if it was better or worse, but, you know, I'm just pretty much out of time now where I'm just trying to think of something and actually just get it done. You know,
right,
I'm like,
right.
I don't even care if it sucks anymore. It's like, I just want to do it because, like, you obviously, like, not only learn so much from just seeing what goes into getting something done, but you're, you know, you're putting something out there that maybe someone will see one day. Who knows?
Yeah, because, like, like short film, like, or making films, especially at the beginning when you, like, nobody knows who you are. It's not like stand up where you can go to an open mic and it doesn't really take many resources. Yeah. So, you know how that's why, like, it's weird when people say, man, it must be so hard to get on stage. It's like, no, it's really not. You just go to that place and you go up, yeah. Whether you do bad or good, that's a different thing. But mm-hmm. with like making a short film, no matter how short it is, like it's a lot of work, especially if it's your first few times where you don't know a lot,
yeah.
and you can go to film school, you start realizing, yeah, man, this is really harder than I thought.
Yeah. It's cool that you even adapted, because we did one short film that I kind of helped AJ out with, but it was AJ's idea. And then we tried to put it into a festival in Calgary. And then the Calgary festival was like, it has to be bear themed. And we're like, no, we're not doing that. We're sending it anyway.
And I was like, nah. We just ignored it. They were like, it has to either have the animal bear or just the word bear in it somehow. But we did a silent movie. So that was nothing to do with it. And they were like, it also has to be like isolation related. I'm like, no, I like it the way it is. If you guys want to have it, that's good. If not, I'm still gonna do it.
Yeah, like we'll have like a bear in the logo, but if that's it, but it is like a weird thing to do it, because like I actually wanted to get into making short films a couple years ago. I've actually like the whole reason why I even got into stand up was because of like television and film, and it was like I think what happened was my brain went tunnel vision in stand up for the first 10 years where I never thought about anything. And in the past couple of years, especially moving to Los Angeles, I really felt like I was now able to like hone other skills that I've put on the back burner.
Yeah.
And I've always known like basic editing and all that stuff, but I'm like, let me really get better at it, you know, like go like full Kung Fu styles, like watch like YouTube videos every day, like training and all that shit. And then I told myself I wanted to do like 5 or 6 short films, because unlike open mics, they are very expensive to do, because, you know, first of all, people who have never acted before apparently have prices that you need to pay them. And you're like, hey, like, I thought we're just trying to make something for fun here.
Fun,
you know, you know, I didn't know that you were a union worker who's never been on set before.
And they don't realize that you're losing money.
Yeah, and no one cares. Everyone, and that's the biggest, I think, difference that's happened in Toronto, especially since I've started, is like, everyone has this price that I don't fully, like, I get it. You need to have like a cost and you need to respect yourself, but you also need to like do shit to earn that price, you know? And especially in like a film side of it, it's like, look, like none of us know what's going on. Like I'll give you money because I understand how it is good to feel appreciated, but like, don't tell me you need like hundreds of dollars a day, because I'm like, who the hell are you? You know, like you're not helping this at all. Like, I just wanted to like eat some pizza, have some beers and film some stupid shit.
Yeah.
And then over time, I essentially had to learn how to do more and more stuff by myself, because I'm like, I just got to cut everybody else out.
Absolutely.
And then just figure out how to do it by myself. So then that way I could have the smallest possible crew or team of actors, whatever.
Yep.
And the last one, the pandemic one, I kind of went in there with a mission in my brain, because it's the third short film I did. And that one was the first one where I decided that I'm not going to listen to anybody anymore. I'm like, you know, as a comedian, we need responses, you know? So scripts are hard to write, because you're like, is this funny? Is it this? Is it that? I need to like read it to all my friends and get their, you know, their
people
reaction
that you trust,
to
people
it.
That you trust, yeah.
Yeah, because you can't just kind of, as a comic, throw something out there and just not hear a laugh or a noise, you know? Yeah. Like, it's hard. Like, you think that it's bombing.
Yeah.
So I would run scripts by so many people, and then they would have so many inputs, and then the idea would get so confused and off track of what I initially wanted.
You're compromising your own vision to what you want.
Yeah,
it to
exactly.
Be.
And it's also, I've never proven myself. So it's the same thing as someone thinking that they deserve money. I've never proven that I could write a short film or a movie or a
direct
TV
it.
Show.
Yeah, yeah.
Or direct it, you know? So I was listening to everybody, but this time around, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to do what I want to do. And I am happy to say that it's the first one out of all of them that did make it into like two film festivals. And then I also got contacted by someone they wanted to license it for like 6 months or something, some sort of horror app in the States. So
that's great. It's
pretty cool.
Hey,
yeah.
That's great, man. No, I like 100% agree with everything you're saying. Cause I'm like, also when I first started doing comedy 4 years ago, I was like, I want to do stand up, but I also want to make like short films. So that's the same thing. And in the beginning I was like writing scripts, but then it just became tunnel vision on stand up. And then, you know, especially through this pandemic, like Jason told you, we did the first one and it was just me and him and I was holding the camera. And so I was doing the same thing, just go on YouTube, like filmmaking 101, like lighting and like stuff like that and justifying camera movements and all that shit. But the guy that edited for us, Patrick Coppolino, like he was, he did it all in one sitting, but you know, he
went
to
school for like, he's a bit more.
He knows what he's doing.
But also at the same time, he was, he never like asked us for anything. I think we just bought him dinner. Like, that's it.
He was very cool.
But he was also like, he knew, right? So,
And that's what you need to be like surrounded by is like, obviously, look, man, we're not stupid. We all want to make money.
Of course.
Like, we're not here trying to float around life, you know? But it's like, there is a process of like creativity and experimenting that you really need to do that sometimes doesn't involve.
Well, I mean, I just, I don't, this might sound pretentious, but like, it just seems like, you know, artists, quote unquote, don't believe in like the artist's journey anymore. Like nobody wants to like, kind of like suffer through it a little bit, at least for the beginning and kind of find out what their voice is. And just like, everybody wants to be like making it from the get go.
Right.
And especially comedy and filmmaking, those are the two industries or professions that don't really have many proteges in it. Like acting, somebody might never have acted, but as soon as they're in front of the camera the first time, they just have it. But filmmaking and comedy, it's years of like experimenting and failing and just
a
long learning process.
But nobody does that anymore, right? Like nobody wants it. Like, but I'm lucky kind of like to be surrounded with people and friends that are kind of understand that, like Jason and like Patrick and so many other guys. But yeah, man, it's like really frustrating when you hear somebody saying like, oh, I need to get paid for this. I'm like, I'm losing money. I'm renting equipment.
And again, it's like, I'm not against the idea of paying because as a performer, I like to get paid even $20, you know, but it's like when you come in with these like high demands and you haven't done anything, you just, it's just like, look, I don't want to waste my time working with you. It's not even worth it, first of all. And I was actually talking with somebody kind of about what you're talking about, but with Kate Trevor. You know, you look at K-Trev, and I really think that he has a very traditional style of how a comedian gained fame. You know, he was a comic for like 15 years, honed his act, and then broke into TV. Now, he had a killer act in his back pocket, but people who watched Letterkenny didn't know maybe that he was a comedian. Yep. I've opened for him in the States and these people come out in full costume dressed like his character in the show and they've never seen him do stand-up before. Now you have a following based off of a show that you're on, okay, because your character is memorable, lovable, and then you have in your back pocket a killer 60 plus minutes of stand-up. That's how, in my opinion, stars and are like born, you know, like, cause you think about like Chris Rock and even Chappelle and, you know, a bunch of even Seinfeld, all them, like they were all working the road before they got on TV, you know? And that was, there was a grinding process. There was a eating shit phase. There
paying
was
their dues.
And I do think it's like, you know, one of the first things I heard about like comedy, and I think it is true still, is that like the idea of overnight success is like 10 years, you know? And it's like, there is a long process in stand-up, but we're in a very fast-paced age now.
No, people it's like you said, just coming in with those demands. Like we've all met comics who like, especially in AJ and I, I'm sure you have too, where comics that are like, we've known that are like a year or two in that are like, I don't do open mics anymore. I'm only doing.
I'm going straight to the
top. I can't help you, dude. You're beyond my help.
Yeah.
There's nothing I can say to you anymore. You already feel like you're there. So what am I going to say?
Jason knows this person without name dropping. But what happened was the one time I got a message from a comic who told me, well, he's not really a comic, but he's been doing it for a while. He goes, there's a show. I'm supposed to do a show in Brantford. You can do it instead. And it pays, and I go like, why don't you want to do it? He goes, because it doesn't pay too much. It only pays $40. And I'm like, well, that's almost kind of you're saying that I'm okay with it. Like, I'll still do it and I'll do it. Yeah. But it's kind of like, you can, like, you think less of me that, like, I mean, I'll do it.
Scraps out.
To I'll do it for free. But I mean, the fact that you posed it that way, just like, you know.
It's not you or K-Trev turning down a low paying.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
This is a guy
you probably never hear of.
Who's been doing it the same amount of time as AJ and is not as good. To be honest, AJ,
but you know what the thing is, K-Trev would do that show for $20, even to this day, you know. And that's the difference of like a great comic to someone who's trying to do stand-up is like, you don't think like K-Trev, Dave Merhej, all like Nathan McIntosh, all these guys have, they still do these killer shows for no money because they just love stand-up, you know. Right. Obviously there is a different idea when you do have a name, like if you're selling a show based off of a comedian's name, then it's like, okay, like now it's a different thing. But when you're asked like, hey man, I got a show going on, and then like, you know, like, and they pop in, they're gonna do it. They're not expecting things because they understand the process. But if you're selling the show in either not telling them that they're gonna be there without their permission, that's a whole other scenario.
Yeah, there's stories of like Doug Stanhope doing like backyard shows, and like if he's doing a theater show in a certain town, like a fan of his will be like, hey, I have a backyard party, you want to do like time and on it? He'll just show up drunk and just do it, whatever.
I heard that he wanted to like corner the backyard market.
He just, like, you know, it's a guy that loves just doing stand-up, and it's the same thing, like, goes back to like even the filmmaking stuff. Like, you, when you did your, you know, first three, you weren't like you're like, oh, I'm gonna make a killing or whatever. You're just gonna be like, I want to get better at this. I want to put it out there, and hopefully, like, my next project will even be better and better. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's the right approach to it, you know. And like you said, obviously, we want to make money off of something that we love doing. Even if it does happen, like you said, it's not gonna happen right away, and it's okay. And that's okay. Like, people need to be okay with that, because at the end of the day, we're really not doing something that's really important. Like, we're not curing cancer. We're not, you know, we're making things that we like. Nobody asks us to be comics. Nobody asks us to be directors or anything like that. You do it because you love doing it. So if you do it because you want to get paid, then that's okay. But just, like, it sucks.
If you're here only to get paid, you're insanely delusional. Beyond regular levels of delusion.
It's like there's no helping you if you're that new and you're demanding money. I'm like, I can't even talk to you about comedy anymore. I can't talk to you about,
no,
you're just too far gone as far as I'm concerned.
And you know what, that's a good thing, a good point, is like, I also personally feel like people just don't talk about comedy anymore, you know. Like, I remember, and maybe I'm just kind of out of the mix, but I feel like the general public of comedians don't like talk about comedy anymore. It's just more of like a thing where it's just like, oh, gotta do my 9 to 5, and then we just end up at the bar, and then nobody talks about it. There's still obviously groups of people who sit down in diners after and go over all their shit, but I just don't think it's as much of a thing, like a fun thing as it was, because there is such a business behind it now, you know.
And it's really scary. And I find even a lot of comics, I find, aren't comedy fans anymore.
No.
Where AJ and I will stand outside having a smoke or something, and we're quoting other comics' jokes.
Yeah, we're not even talking about our own jokes. Stuff. We're just like, hey, I heard this comic and like an album in 85, and they said that joke, and like, and like, that's so fucking, it's just like, there's no more, everybody's like serious about it. And if you notice that famous comedians, when they talk about like their best years, it's back when they were not famous.
When they didn't know what was happening.
And when they didn't know what was happening, that was the fun period where we would go to a diner and just, like, you know, they were poor and talk about jokes.
It wasn't all business.
Yeah, but I think a lot of the comics that are starting now, if some of them do get famous, I don't think they'll ever have like good memories of like, oh, I, because none of them do any of that fun stuff. Like most comics aren't even fun to hang out with outside of comedy. There's no more fun comics anymore even.
And that's the whole thing that's really like, it's just turned into, like such a serious thing. And the people are just like, they're just like, I don't even know what it, I don't even know how to explain it without it really sounding bad. But I just think that people need to like really like find the love in it. And it's like, it is obviously a business. There is a business side to being a comedian. But at the end of the day, it's like, if all you're worried about is making money, you're not going to build an act for yourself. You're not going to do anything. You're going to write an act that can make you money, you know? And that's the hard thing where, you know, like comics who like typically like are storytelling comics, you can always tell the ones that are just living a crazy life that have the ability to tell stories, or ones that are putting themselves in crazy situations just to talk about things on stage. And those are the people that are typically a little annoying to hang out with, you know, where they're like, oh, let me go jump into this group of six drunk guys leaving a club and see what happens. Yeah. And it's like, that's kind of like, you're obviously gonna get the shit kicked out of you.
It's gross.
To, you know, to get an act or to get like a video or something, you know? Right. And it's like, where I think the difference are.
Yeah, it's really gross that you see that, and you can tell on stage too, like that they're not fun to be around either.
Yeah.
And everybody's just like really so serious, and there's no like fun comics to hang out with after shows. Like everybody, you know, obviously we all do our share of shit talking other comedians. That's true, but like at some point, we all know when to turn that off and just have fun. But then you just have the comics who, once you stop shit talking other comics, they just run out of stuff to say. And it's like, oh, you don't have a personality beyond just doing comedy. Like you think that comedy is your whole identity. And I think that's a bad thing. Like there's a difference between loving comedy and having a passion for it and just doing it just to seem interesting. Like that just, that's boring as fuck, I think.
Oh, I was just going to get into other stuff about you, is just as far as like, I can tell how much you love comedy because you've done so many different things in comedy that I sometimes don't see other comics do too. Because like, not only were you stand up, but then also working on short films, but you were also a club owner for a little bit. Like you've taken on...
Yeah. I never heard of this.
No. Oh, you didn't know?
No.
We didn't own the building, but we ran the club for sure.
You ran the club there.
Yeah, we did. It was Garrett Jameson and I. Because that's the thing. Like, I'm always just like, you know, I'll walk into somewhere and be like, okay, we need to do something here, you know? And like, comedy was one of those things.
My wife
where...
and I do that. We'll see a vacant building and be like, this will make a good comedy club. This we're not in any position to run a comedy club, but we still do that just in our heads, you know?
Yeah. And that's the thing. And you know what? Like, I wonder if it's like, I always used to compare like skateboarding to stand-up, because I used to skateboard for the longest period before I started stand-up. And you always look at a handrail and you're like, oh man, I wonder what I could do down this handrail or this ledge. And you like the like basic city structure is not the same anymore. It's now like something that you could do something on or off of. And I did the same thing. You know, I remember we did North by Northeast at the Lower Ossington Theater. And I talked to Barry. I'm like, Barry, man, we got to do something here. Like this space is insane. It had a nice stage. It was like perfect location. Everything was good. We set the meeting up. Barry was getting Comedy Records off the ground and he was like, look, I can't commit, because they wanted a pretty hefty financial commitment from us. And Barry's like, I can't commit. Like, we're Comedy Records is kind of, I got to give it my all right now. And I'm like, that's fine. Do you care if I ask Garrett? And he's like, no, for sure. So then I asked Garrett, and then Garrett's like, yeah, let's do this. And then talk about like the stars aligning. The first night we officially decided to, you know, that we officially like signed the papers, we were at Comedy Bar and Garrett was talking with this guy outside who was looking to film a comedy special and a series, and he couldn't get in touch with some people and had no venue. And then Garrett was like, funny story, I'm actually opening a club next month. And then the guy's like, are you serious? And then Garrett comes in, and it ended up being Rob Shimon, who to this day we're still friends with. And we ended up filming, we ended up having two seasons locked in before we opened the doors to the lot. And it was, you know, it was like an internet public access, above public access thing. It was like a specialty channel. But the first season, you know, it paid $1,000 per comic. And we had 54 comics on, and we put $54,000
What was it into called comics again? Pocket. I've seen no comics kidding. On this. No kidding. That's
no
right.
No kidding. Yeah. So the iChannel's done now. That whole thing, I don't even think it exists anymore. But, you know, it was pretty cool to, like, yeah, like, put $50,000, $54,000 into comics pockets across Canada, like,
right.
before we even opened the door, you know?
That's insane.
So that was a fun time. But, yeah, I just love anything to do with comedy, to be honest with you.
Yeah, well, it shows that, like, that you're even – that you did stuff so much for the community itself, right? That's, like, how you can tell when a guy loves – comedy is like everybody's got a story about you. If it's not your club, it's, you know, it's you reaching out to our buddy Doug Koning, and you guys were going to do Windsor together. It's like you always trying to do stuff, and guys remember stuff like that. Like, I remember the first Pat McDonald took me to open for him at the old Windsor Club when it was the Quarry, and guys like shit like that, right? So
and that's the thing that I think is the most important about comedy, especially because it is such a lonely world, you know, that, like, you do need to have, like, a good crew of friends that you start out with, and then you also need to remember that it is stupid, you know. So it's like, to bring someone out to open with you, it's like, yeah, like, why wouldn't you do that if you had the ability to? But a lot of comics I know don't do that for some reason, or especially in Canada, people are so tight with their contacts because there's so little contacts to go around that everyone's like walking around like it's like Fight Club or like CIA agents, like with a secret spy mission, you know?
Yeah.
No, that was another thing, like, that I always noticed about you is you're like, well, if you're out west, talk to this place or talk to that place. You're very open about stuff. It's not, you're not one of those secretive dudes. You're very much like, no, this is what you got to do, and it will be fun, and you can work.
Yeah. I know my act, and I know what it can do. Okay. So I'm not going to tell you that I'm going to go out to Alberta, Grand Prairie, and I'm going to be the draw of the town. You know, like, I know that it's going to be a battle. But I used to go out there because of all the local shows. I used to love doing the local shows like Underdog and Empress and Comedy Monday Night. So those shows are why I would go out there. The road shows was fucking disaster. Like, I was like fighting people all the time. Like, people would come up to me in the bar after and yell at me. And this is like to the last days of going out there pre-COVID. And I would never be someone like, my mentality was to bring an opener who I knew was going to do way better than me, because I would rather somebody go up to you and be like, you know what, you should have headlined than them hating the whole show. Because I know that I can get by, you know, if the audience is not drunk off their mind and, you know, they're into whatever the hell it is I'm talking to, we're going to have a fun time. But most of the time, it's like not exactly like that. So there would be so many times where they would go up to the opener and they'd be like, you should have headlined, and then just like stare me down as they're leaving. And I'm like, well, this is it, you know, I don't know.
What are you going to do? That is what it is.
That's the best about when you're not doing well. The worst thing in comedy when you're not doing well, it's not heckling. The worst thing is glares.
It's disappointment.
Yes, they glare at you when they're so fucking mad. They're just staring you down. I'm like, that's the worst.
They're trying to break you, and you just don't let them.
Yeah, yeah. And I just go,
that's the worst that you. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember which album of yours that had it, but you were talking about like how as a comic you have to be funnier than what the audience, but funnier than how the audience think they are.
Because
everybody thinks they're funny. So the comic has to be insanely funny. But then you did like a situation about like the elevator thing. And it was like, it was so funny to me because the next day, like, I literally was bombing the night before, and the next day I go into work and I was in the elevator and I literally just made an observation, and then just like three people were dying. I was like so mad.
That's the bar of comedy. It's different, you know, in on a stage to an elevator.
No, it was just such a perfect, like, simple analogy, but it was just so true. That was like that. But I also like saw something that you posted a few months ago that you did like a pamphlet on how like to do comedy. Well, like with
that Garrett, was from an older
with,
album.
With too. Garrett, with, no, well, not the pamphlet that he gives out on Who's Mark DeBonis, but the one that he gave out where Garrett Jameson was doing the illustrations.
Oh, yeah,
like a guide to comedy, like what to expect and whatnot. Like, and it was like very, very sweet and very nice. It was like a dad talking. It was like really. It was like a sage dad. It was like because usually I hate these things. Like, because a lot of comics have them, and like some guy that's like 5 months in, and they're like. What I've learned so far. I'm like, shut up.
Yeah, that one
was like, it wasn't pretentious. It was like very nice, down to earth. It was like really cool.
Yeah, no, it was something that I've been like thinking about a lot. It was like my, you know, an air quoting philosophy and theory on stand-up comedy. And it's like, I always love doing like analogies and comparing comedy to different things throughout my whole career. And I'd always talk with comics like Ron Jostel or Garrett or whatever. And I'm always like throwing these like weird analogies out. And then like, sometimes I'd be like, man, I should like write this down. And then I remember talking with Ron about the whole thing that happened with COVID and cruise comedy pretty much is done right now.
Right.
And then we were talking about the idea that there are comics who are just cruise comics, because you get into that world, you don't leave because you make a shitload of money. You're touring on a cruise almost 50 weeks of the year.
A boatload of money.
You're making a boatload of money, big boats. And like,
this podcast is canceled.
This is that one. Yeah, that was quick. No, but we're talking about it. And then, you know, I just also love like Kung Fu movies and like all this stuff. And then I was just talking to Ron about how when you train only one hand, if you cut your hand off,
you're useless.
So then I started talking about this whole body of comedy. And he's like, man, like, you got to like write that down or something. He's like, you got to like start putting this out there. Cause, you know, I was saying the body of comedy is like one hand's cruise comedy, the other hand's club comedy, open mics, the road, or your two legs. And then so from there, I was like, you know what? Like, I'm not doing anything. Let me just go through all my old notes and just my brain and write every that I could remember and hopefully make it make sense. Every thought I've ever had on comedy, like not trying to, you know, teach anything or whatever. Like, it was just like, this is my personal outlook and thoughts on stand-up in general and joke writing and persona, finding your voice and all that.
Yeah.
Right. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your voice too. Because I got a question about it. Because I'll say this, a lot of comics, I get a bit of a lisp. I sound like I eat cigarettes, you know what I mean? Some comics will do impressions of me. Yeah. I've never heard a more impersonated comic than you.
Yeah.
But only off stage. Did you ever feel, because I find you have such a unique voice, did you ever feel like there was a problem where somebody was trying to do your voice on stage? Or was everybody always pretty respectful of that?
On stage, there was a period, I'll tell you the truth, where, you know, you could always tell when you're making a difference in the world of comedy when people are trying to do your shit on stage. And it really did. I don't think I ever saw anybody try and do my voice on stage. Like, and if they were, it was like, they'd be like, oh, that's like a DeBonis joke. And they'd have like a stupid theory or thought. But it did like come to my attention that off stage, a lot of people are impersonating me and all this stuff. And I've never really heard a good one, and I know people think that they have done good ones or heard good ones, but
to me it just
doesn't ever sound that good. But I've never heard anyone on stage really try and talk like me, or, you know, like sound how I sound, you know. I've heard. I don't know why though.
And this is my theory, is because your topics of jokes are so like niche and specific that if any comic were to do something that's slightly close to that, immediately they'll get called out.
Like,
that's
a DeBonis. That's a DeBonis. Like, people
like,
would know.
Yeah. Like, if somebody does a joke about like denim on denim, like nobody's gonna be like, that's a DeBonis. Stop.
That is good. That's good. I'd rather people not be able to talk about my premises than talk.
You're very specific, man. You're very specific, and it's like, it's just so hard to. I've been like honestly like a big fan of yours like ever since I started doing comedy. And one of the things that I know you might not like this, but I love your attitude about like how much like you think like, oh, it's a silly idea for a joke, but I'm just gonna go ahead and do it.
Yeah,
and I just don't care. And like that attitude was like so like, it kind of encouraged me a little bit to be more relaxed on stage and just kind mm-hmm. of like do what I want to do. Cause I'm like, man, if this guy has so much confidence, you know, talking to a crowd that like is like really not interested, but yeah. he still gives it his all talking about like, you know, ruffling plastic bags and stuff like that. And it's just so fun. It's funny to me, but I'm just, you can yeah. tell that the audience is like, what the hell is happening here?
Yeah.
But I'm like, man, this guy's really like, he's got balls. And it was just really like, I don't want to use the word inspiring, but like, it was yeah. kind of like, really like, man, like it's really encouraging to see that.
There's something to me that I don't understand why, but I just find it hilarious when people are confused when I'm talking. And
it
like,
is hilarious.
That's why, like, if I laugh a lot, I'm not, like, laughing at my jokes. I'm laughing at reactions of people in the crowd. And there's, like, periods where I'm like, okay, let me see how much I can really just be, like, a shit disturber and talking about something that's going to piss off people where they're, like, genuinely, like, confused and concerned. And they're like, what the hell is happening? And, like, I think I definitely lost a lot of my original presence or whatever when I first started, because I used to, you know, I was bigger. I used to talk a little bit more slow paced, and everyone thought I was just high all the time. And I think getting through that period where I don't smoke weed and like legitimately arguing with the audience because they thought I was lying to them, like, there's shows where people are being like, stop fucking lying to us. We know you're high. We paid to come here. And I'm like, I'm not fucking high. You know, like, I don't know what you want me to tell you. Like, why would I lie about this?
Jesus.
And like, it would be like a thing where it would, that all that stuff just made everything just so much easier after, because the first couple of years, there are people like Jeff Leeson, like, you know, from London, like he brought me out with him to probably 30, 40 shows plus, where I was doing 30 minutes opening for him in my first year.
Oh my
because
God.
I just kind of like lied to him. And I'm like, yeah, I got 30 minutes, but I had like 8 minutes in Toronto and like four of it was on the bus. And like by like the 15th, 20th show, like I remember just being with Jeff and I'm like, look, man, like, are you fucked? Like, do you have, like, why do you want to see me die all the time on these shows?
Stop bringing
like,
me.
Is this something that you have in your head? Like, what's going on? And he's like, he started laughing and he's like, look, Mark, you've never lost me a show and you're just fun to be on the road with. And he's like, I would rather be on the show with you than someone who's going to do well and not be fun to hang out with.
Right.
And this whole process of being in situations where I shouldn't be in time-wise or show-wise, you know, it really made me stay hard-headed in what I want to do, like material wise. So when I'm talking about like, you know, ice cubes or whatever, and the audience is getting mad, I'm like, let me see how far I can push this before it's like my version of an edgy joke, you know, just annoying.
Yeah. No, it's just ruffling some feathers. I remember you were time like you were doing like you were at Emerson here in Hamilton. You were talking
yeah.
about doors and door frames, and people were like really yeah. upset. But I was yeah. just like in the back, just like, this is so hilarious that this guy is so committed to talk about yeah. doors. And it's like, and I'm laughing at people because I'm looking at people's reaction and hearing your voice, and it's just making me cry. Just like.
Yeah.
Like, I understand why people are not getting this.
It's also so funny when you're saying something that's clearly not offensive.
Yeah.
Like, you just don't think it's good and they get so fucking mad.
So this is the thing that really always confuses comics who have never seen me on the road, because people are like, man, you must be like walking through, you know, because they see me do well at an open mic or they see me do well at the Alt Dot in the past, you know, and they were like, oh, you have the perfect life, man. You go on stage, you talk about fucking door frames, people are dying. And I'm like, have you seen me outside of the city? I like, legitimately am fighting audience members on the road. Like, I've had peanuts thrown at me. I've had paper towels thrown at me. I've had people threaten and wait for me after the show.
Oh my God.
I'm not talking about anything edgy. Offensive.
No.
I'm just angering them so much that they want to fight me. Like, it's
They've paid insane, money to come see you, and then they like
they're so mad.
And they're just not your crowd. They're just not your crowd. But you have the right attitude where you're like, I just have to still do the road, because a lot of Toronto comics or city comics in general, if they're doing so well in the city, they're too scared to be on the road.
Yeah, and go back like, on that. Yeah,
you got to leave your bubble, even if it is going to London or Hamilton.
Doesn't
like,
matter.
It is a completely different mentality, you know. Like it is a different vibe because you get comfortable in your bubble, and then you think that you're like the king of the bubble or the queen of the bubble, whatever. Then you leave, it doesn't go well, and then you come back, and then you shit talk the city. And that's something that I've heard a lot of people do about like Toronto, like in the past, you know, where they would be from somewhere else, come to Toronto, and it's like, look, we got to look at what it is. Toronto's the fastest paced city in Canada. It's the most the biggest population, one of the most diverse. You're getting a lot of different things happening there.
Yep.
And it's not going to change your life as a comedian. It might make you better, but it's not going to like give you like some crazy career. That's just not what Canada does.
No.
But you got to be able to like hold your own in Toronto, because there are going to be a lot of good comics. There's going to be audiences that don't care. There's going to be audiences that have been to a lot of shows and some that haven't and still don't care, you know? And you can't just go on the, you know, in Toronto and talk about road stuff, because people are like, we don't care, you know? Like, why are you talking to us about this?
Yeah.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So, and it's also,
you need to get outside your bubble.
Yeah. And it's also, Toronto's an important city to do well in. Like,
you
have to be able to do well in Toronto, because you might also, you know, another comic who's more experienced than you will take you on the road because they liked you.
Yeah.
You might not necessarily have done well, but they just love your attitude. They love what you talk about. And it's a city to make connections in, right? Yeah. So, yeah.
It is, because it is one of the major hubs of Canada, you know.
Absolutely. Like, big time.
There's no denying that.
No, it's like you said. It's just like either way. You know what I mean? Because I started in London, and that's when we first met, was in London.
Yeah.
And then I moved to Hamilton, and then Toronto was a bit of a learning curve. But going again and again and again, now I'm getting booked on shows in Toronto, and I know comics in Toronto, and you're able to work it more. And
exactly.
Just make it work for you, right? But that all comes just with like not doing it once, bombing, and then being like, oh, fuck that city. Yeah. They're just assholes anyways. And I hate it when, because it really does bother me when a Toronto comic will come to Hamilton and then they'll be like, hey, great set. And then they go, I never do well here. I'm like, it takes some time. And they're like, yeah, I guess a lot of stool humping and stuff like that. I'm like, well, I didn't do that. I didn't hump a fucking stool. So you just said good set. And now you're saying that they only like sex stuff. But it's like, I don't do a bunch of, you know what I mean? So it's like, what are you even saying?
That's like the level of like pretentiousness. And that's like, you know, one of the times where I was in Calgary or Grand Prairie, I was with a comic and we almost got into a fight after, because the guy hated my act but loved the opener. And I had to like legitimately just sit there and eat this shitty pan pizza while this guy's yelling at me about how I ruined his anniversary. Because if I were to be like, oh, well, something, it's just going to now make the other comic feel bad because he loved him. So
right,
I'm like,
and
I'm like, I get it. Like, you might not like me, you might like him, but it's like, you can't blame a whole thing on like stupidness or whatever. It's just the audience is, comics are really good at making it everything but them is the problem, you know?
Right. Calling an entire crowd dumb, or that whole city's dumb. It's
a
like
whole city,
a whole city's dumb. Yeah. You're smarter than an entire city. It's like, fucking relax, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Not one salvageable person is in this fucking shit.
No.
Just dreading having to drive there because my presence is needed in Hamilton.
I hope some Old Testament plague fucking hits all of you.
It's just brutal. When people act like St. Catharines be better off like bombed or something.
Yeah,
then I'm like, you know what?
Oh, but yeah, it's why are you even there then? Like,
then
don't
why go.
Go.
Then don't go.
Yeah,
Stay away from it if you hate it that much.
Yeah, because you know? Monty Scott had such a funny line one time. I was at an open mic. It was a shitty open mic. I think it was my first year doing comedy. And he was on stage, and it was like all the new comics were so miserable. And then he comes on stage. He goes, guys, you all know you can quit if you want to. Right? Like, you guys don't have to be here.
No one's keeping you there.
Yeah, like you literally can just walk so and never look back. And I'm like, it's so true. It's so true.
They just keep getting on the mic and then trashing the mic.
Because he then went on and worked on some jokes, and he had fun. You know, I mean, again, it's a horrible open mic, but you know that going in there. Nobody ambushed you. Like, it's not like somebody had like a banner for Yuck Yucks, and as soon as you walked in, they took it off. Like you knew. You knew it was
a wide bar. Never tricked. You always know when it's a bad show before you do it.
Yeah.
And that to me is always what I call like the disease of like scenes, you know, because when people never leave their bubble, they all start talking about the same thing. They start like talking, they have the same attitude. And I guarantee you all those comics probably went to the same shows with each other and just shit on the show. And it's like, you're not really doing anything. Like, trust me, I am for sure like a self-deprecating comic. I will at times make fun of everything around it, but it's like, first of all, I didn't start out like that. Like, that's something that happened over time. And second of all, it's like, you need to be able to also get out of it, you know, because like one thing I would do and a lot of like older comics would tell me was like, you bring, and I still do it to this day, is like, I bring it down too much, where I point out too much about how this is not going well or whatever. And then the audience eventually starts to think like, is he not doing well?
Yeah.
Like, right, because they don't know the difference if you can just go through it. And it is like a bad habit to get into, because I'm definitely guilty of it too, but I fight not to, unless the audience is really in a good mood and I can joke around.
Then you kind of do that. Yeah. Right, yeah.
Then you go back and forth, but to like really just have a whole act built off of ripping the show apart, like that will follow you forever, you know?
Yeah, it's you're picking up a bad habit that's going to be very hard to get rid of.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, again, it just goes to show you that just like, you know, comedians in general are just like so self-absorbed and just how.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's me, you know, everything is just about them. Yeah. And it's, and again, like nobody's really forcing. Again, the world is not asking for people to become comedians. You choose to do it. And if you choose to do something that you love, why not try to do it to the best of your abilities? That's the part that really frustrates me so much, because you could, like, I mean, I've only been doing comedy for 4 years, but I kind of have a sense of when I see a comic, when they try a new joke, you can tell, even though it might not be funny, but you can tell that like there's some thought that went into it and they're trying to work on. As opposed to a comic that, I hate these comics who, whenever like an important event happens in the world, and they immediately have a joke about it, and they try to be like like relevant like, and shit like that. Like, hey guys, so you know, this Bush administration bubble, and like I know I went way back. I picked a really horrible.
He's actually the oldest comic on this.
I am. I've been doing it.
9/11, Bush.
I've been doing a lot of old references. Yeah, yeah. You know, the problem with the Reagan administration is just that
I totally agree with what you're saying. You know, I think like every comic has their own process and figuring it out for sure. I think the thing that at the end of the day that kind of bothers me about stand-up is that it became like this thing of who's the most real. And it's not a joke anymore. It's
Exactly.
And that to me is like the thing where I'm like, this is a fucking joke, you know? Like, this is not like, when people find out that some of the stuff I say is like made up and it's not real,
exactly.
They're like, what? That didn't happen to you? I'm like, why do you think this would happen to me? Like, I'm not here trying to change the world, you know? I'm here to make up a stupid situation and make someone laugh for 2 seconds and then move on with my thought, you know? And I get it. It's, we're in that time of like, you know, everyone's coming out of who they are and what they are,
but
it's
like,
it's like this, it's just, to me, I don't know. Like, it's just like stand-up has always been like an escape from reality to me, like, or just the idea of like comedy in general.
Right.
And I think that it really did lose that meaning over the past couple of years. And it's not just Toronto, it's everywhere.
And I think that there's dishonesty and when they say that too, because though I've been on shows before where it's like, yo, it's the dark, real show. And it's like, it advertises that. I know I got booked on it for some reason. I don't know why I'm your guy, but sure. But then the first three comics that go up are doing jokes about fucking babies. And I'm like, well, this isn't real.
Yeah.
You guys don't fuck babies. Dude, you're normal guys.
Dude, exactly. You know what I mean? Patton Oswalt had such a funny joke where you go, like, you'll see a lot of comedians who, before they start their set, they'll tell you how dark they are. Believe me, those comics aren't dark. The ones that you need to be worried about are the ones that are going on stage talking about spoons and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Those are the scary comics. Like if somebody, and it's so true. Like you see it so many times when you see a comic, even like in Toronto scene or whatever, they're like, I'm so fucked up. I'm so fucked up. Yeah. And like, you're not. You are absolutely not.
And going back to Monty, it's like Monty doesn't have to tell you that how real he is. You can just see Monty and be like, this guy's seen some shit. You know what I mean? Like, that Monty
is on his face.
Like he's trying not, he's not trying to be somebody that he's not. You know what I mean? Like Monty is who he is and he doesn't need to spoon feed you telling you how real he is or how dark he is whatever, you know, like, and
his jokes will do that.
His jokes, his demeanor, his, you know, his whole presence will make you realize that this guy is who he says he is. And he's talking about what he wants and you really will not break him for the most part, you know? Right. And that to me is like more real than you telling me that you're real, you know?
There's something more fake than you telling me how real you are.
And it's also like those comics are pretty much saying that any one-liner comic is not funny. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, like
this is a whole other thing.
I hate the whole thing of like comedy has to be real. And like, no, comedy has to be funny. And if it can be real, I mean, I guess that's a bonus, and, but like it has to be funny.
Yeah, and it's like there's a whole stigma about having like a written joke where it's like hack now to have like an act, you know, where it's like, and that to me is such a small-minded thing because that's not going to work on a big scale, you know, like it really won't. And again, there's always loopholes. Like if you have a social media following or whatever, then you do whatever the hell you want. But if you're taking a traditional path in comedy, you know, people are not going to book you because of how free you are on stage. They're going to book you because it's consistent. You know, they're going to book you because they know they're paying you for something. They're not paying you for you
to chat
because you're nothing if you don't have a following. You know, they don't care. Yeah. They want your act. You know, maybe they're friends with you and then that's a different story, but
not everybody is.
Think about a showcase. You have like 5 minutes. Like you can't go up there and just let the audience know what's happening in the world. They're going to be like, who is this kid telling me what the hell's happening? I have four kids. I don't care about this.
Shut up.
You know, just do a fucking joke and get out of here.
It bothers me sometimes, but it's like some comics that say that they only write on stage almost look down on you for writing jokes out verbatim.
So
and I'm like, why is that?
That's so stupid.
I did my homework. Like, why is that? Why do I have to feel lame for studying before I went and
like, what are you, some nerd?
I know. That's what they should be like. They should be like, I'm so a fucking nerd for writing my jokes.
But that just shows you like that a lot of people, not just comedians, are very impressionable because when you find like a famous comic who you are enamored by, and then they have like a free flowing style.
Yeah.
You think that like, oh, I can do that.
Yeah.
But like not realizing that you can be a fan of a style, but that doesn't mean that that style is something that you can pull off. Like just because you're a
and
fan
the
of
years and the years
exactly.
that go into it.
Exactly.
You know? Because
exactly.
it's like even someone like I've known people who have worked with Dave Chappelle and it's like, he really has this conversational free flowing thought. But every single person I heard that worked with him said that when he used to get off the stage, he would just go right in the back and sit in the green room and write. He would like write shit down. He would be like writing. And it's like, don't get me wrong. There is no rules of comedy. Like if you're on stage and it works, do whatever the hell you want to do. But when you start like bringing down other people or thinking that you're better than them because you didn't write something, it's like, okay, well, that worked at this shitty open mic in the back of a fucking chicken wing place. What are you gonna do on the road, what are you going to do on showcase? If you get a TV spot, what are you going to do then? You know, like.
Yeah. Yeah. You see those comedians who are like, every time you see them, like have a new five and like, none of them are like solid or like anything, but they're just like, they pride themselves on like, every time you see me, I got new, like, yeah, well, yeah, good for you. But like, none of them are usable. Good. If I were to book you on to do a showcase, you wouldn't be able to know which joke to pick.
You never brag about owning three broken cars.
Yeah, exactly. That's pretty much what it is. Yeah. So yeah. Yeah, that's where it is. Yeah.
I want to ask you too, is that like, just coming back to you, like sometimes you being self-deprecating when you don't feel like they're liking you so much, how do you toe that line? Because you're one of the few guys that I've seen bomb very funny, like your joke's not going well, but you commenting on how it's not going well, and then you end up killing.
Yeah.
How do you find that where you don't convince them like, oh, I am bad by deprecating, like by too much self-deprecation?
Personally, if I had to think what I thought it was, I first of all, don't ever let them actually like break me, you know, like I'm in on the joke also where I'm like, my biggest tool and flaw is how aware I am on stage, where I can feel when the audience is starting to lose interest. Mm-hmm. And then, so that's the point where I typically start to laugh. Because I'm like, okay, these people are about to get mad, or they're like they're hanging on to what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And it's like, when that part starts to happen, I'll give it some more time to play out. And if they're still not laughing, I'll like just kind of try and comment on what's going on and be also an audience member watching me, being like, you know, the basic shit where I'm like, look, I know how this is going, you know, talk about that, comment on it. But get back into the act, and you know, because at the end of the day, when you have the confidence and you don't let them think that you suck, then they will think that they're wrong, and then they'll start coming back around. It's the idea of being like, look, I'm aware that this is not working right now, let's just get through this, we're adults, we all paid to be here. And then there is like a little bit of a give and take where, you know, sometimes it doesn't come back, like, and it's like, I've done shows where the audience is like a little bit drunk, or there's big groups of people, and that's always a fight, you know. But when the audience is kind of split up, they don't know each other, and there's a bunch of little groups, you got to have the confidence that what you're talking about will at least hit some tables, and then that will start to spread, because maybe that one joke doesn't work, but then the next one will, and then not breaking and being like stuttering, or you know, losing your thought or whatever. Right. And then there is like a certain, because don't get me wrong, like I might look like I'm calm and collected, but I'm shitting my pants on the inside, because I know that the whole left side is pissed off right now. So I now need to gear it towards them. And then to be honest, I just always find bombing funny. Like, I don't know, since day one, like it's something that I've always found more entertaining. And I think I can't even explain it 100%, because it's something that I've been working on for like 13, 14 years, on how to properly bomb, you know, and how to not give the audience essentially what they want in the bomb scenario.
You're like, no matter how funny your friends are, your comedian friends are, there's nothing funnier that they can come up with other than them bombing on stage.
Watching
like just seeing a friend bomb is hilarious. It's so hilarious to me. It's just
that is the best part.
It's so good. It's so good. I just love, like, I was one of your albums. I remember, like, you were talking, and then you said, "Guys, I realized that none of my jokes have an ending," and it was just like, it was just so.
And that's just like those little things where you like point it out, and then they're like, "Oh, he knows too." Okay, good.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of like those little things were little throwaway lines that I would use just for my act, and then comics would be like, "Man, that's actually like pretty funny," and I'm like, "Really? Like, I didn't know." And then I just kept doing it, and it seems to be actually true, you know, like the audience is aware that my jokes don't go anywhere. You know, and I think part of it also is I've always been kind of like a salesman in life, and I think I'm like so committed to a premise that the audience is like, "Why is this guy telling me so much about this right now?" And then once you break and you're like, okay, this sucks. They laugh at it because they're like, we thought this was going to go somewhere.
Yeah. Oh, that was it? Oh, my God.
This is going nowhere.
Yeah, it's been nothing better than when you see, like, an audience just be like, oh, that was the joke? Oh, shit. Yeah. fuck. We thought, no, that can't be just the joke. That's impossible.
Do you ever – that's going to kill you if you see people hanging on the edge of their seat thinking it's going to go somewhere else. And then your joke is just like the bird walked away from the other bird, and you're like, "What?"
Yeah, no, but
that's gotta be the best.
It really is, and that is something that I've always had my whole life because my friends hated when I would tell stories because, like, I'd be like, "Man, I was on the bus. This lady came on, and they were like freaking out." And then I'm like, "And then she just got off the bus," and they're like, "And then what happened?" I'm like, "That was it." And they're like, why would you build that story up so much? And, like, it goes nowhere. And that's really my whole act, you know, it is very top heavy.
Yeah, you bring
it, like, really is all. And that's why I'm just so used to just confused because it just goes nowhere at the end of it. You know, it starts off with like a funny premise and they're like, oh, where's this going? And I'm like, nowhere.
And that's where the anger that people show comes from, because it's not that they think that you suck or anything. They're just like, man, you brought our hopes up so many times. We're fed up. Enough of you. And you know, just enough.
This emotional roller coaster of it's too much you for talking about shoelaces is killing me.
I can see, because I go up with Jeff Leeson a lot, and I can only imagine.
Yeah. Yep.
How
you did, you know, at their audiences,
how it went sometimes.
Oh boy.
Kinds of people. And I remember,
I definitely don't see them being a bonus crowd. No,
no,
I remember
Jeff
telling me some stories about like taking you and Terry Curry on the road with him. And but you're also very likable. Like Jeff would be like, I've never seen a comic do so bad, and then have so many people buy him drinks after the show. And
it's
like
true.
Love him again, right? So they come
really,
around on you.
It really, I was in Cranbrook with, I think, Sean Hogan. I brought him out with me, and I was headlining. And Cranbrook is in BC, middle of nowhere, like oil. I don't even know what the hell happens in this town, but they did not like me. Like, it was bad. And after the show, I had a lineup. This is how bad it was. The bartender liked me because she was always there, and I came like once or twice a year. She always was a fan of my stand-up, always was nice to me. She started requesting jokes for me to just perform to her.
Oh my
and the
gosh.
Audience was so mad. Like, they were leaving, they were threatening me, whatever. After the show, I'm sitting in the back, I'm just like, what the hell am I doing with my life? And then there's a lineup of people bringing me gifts of wine and beer and apologizing for how bad the show was, but just letting me know that they didn't like me. They're like, we just don't like you. We're sorry that it went that bad. You seem like a nice guy. Here's a glass of wine. Here's a beer. And there was a lineup of people. And the bartender was like, I've never seen the audience hate somebody so much and spend so much on them at the same time. It's a very weird thing, you know.
People need to sit you down to explain to you. They can't just keep it to themselves. Like, we need to explain to you. And by the way, I've noticed something. Just so the people that are listening don't think that all Mark does is get people angry. Mark is like legitimately one of the funniest guys. Just so you guys know,
it does seem like we're being a little
that's all that Mark does. Listen to his albums. Legitimate, he's one of the most original. And funny guys.
Your new album is out now, Minutia.
Yes.
Right? Also doing comedy records. So.
Yes.
And you have some sketches on there as well.
Yeah. So that was like a new venture that I walked because what happened was I ended up recording the stand-up part of that pre-COVID in Kitchener. I did the Waterloo Comedy Festival. And I ended up opening up for Tom Green and Shane Smith. And so I ended up getting on this show. It was a 300-seat theater. And I was like thinking, and I was like, you know, I was talking to Barry. I'm like, look, man, like, I don't know if I'm going to get a show like this. Like, I have material that I want to do. Some of it's older, but reworked. Some of it's new. And I'm like, I want to just record it to just have it just in case, you know, like to potentially put something out. So we ended up doing the show, recorded it, and it, you know, it went for what it was. And then we just kind of sat on the material for a while. And then Tim Golden messaged Barry or talked to Barry, and he's like, why aren't we releasing this, you know? And then we just kind of wanted to do something a little bit different than just a straight stand-up. And then I came up with the idea of having like kind of sketches that are based off of the jokes, not essentially a sketch of the joke. Like the way I describe it, it would be like the next scene or the scene before. So it would be like, if I'm talking about a pizza thing, the sketch would be the guys in the pizza place before I came in, or the guys in the pizza place after I left, and they're making fun of a character, because I know that what I talk about on stage is a very annoying person in real life. So to create these characters around that, it right. is essentially, you know, so with the joke, with the album, I think there was, I don't know how many stand-up tracks there was, but I think I have like four or five sketches that are intertwined with the actual stand-up. And then the other ones are just random sketches. So if you listen to it, it all kind of flows together in some way.
So it's like audio track of the sketches that you have on.
No, that's the thing. So it is an audio sketch, yeah. But it's like not an audio sketch of the joke. It would like,
it's either before leading up to the joke or the aftermath of the joke. But but it's an audio track of that.
Yes, it's all audio sketches.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So that was a fun time, and I got to work with like Gare Jameson, who was in Winnipeg when he recorded his tracks. Dina was in Toronto when she recorded her tracks, and like we literally recorded the album like internationally, and we were not in the same room together on the sketch side,
right?
Which is a very weird process to do, and it took a little bit more work on the editing side because of timing, but it ended up coming out, I think, pretty good.
Awesome.
Well, man, we're always looking forward to see what you come up with, man. And we think you're very talented and very funny. And we're so happy that you were able to be here with us, man. We appreciate that.
Yeah, and honestly, I feel like we were talking for a long time. I hope this is not too long of a...
No, not at all. Not at all.
Yeah, this is perfect, dude.
We just don't want to drain you too much. That's all.
No, man, I'm definitely always happy to talk. So stand-up isn't really happening right now. So
whenever especially I can now, right? Yeah.
Talk, it's what
so,
it is.
So where can people find you, your social medias? Do you want to plug those real quick?
Just Mark DeBonis on most of the stuff. And then on Twitter, it's the Mark DeBonis. And everything else is just Mark DeBonis. And that's it.
Well, there you go.
The albums are all streamable and all that stuff.
So, yeah, absolutely. Check his new album, Minutia.
On every platform. Yeah, on every iTunes, platform. Spotify, Google Play.
And follow me and Jason on our own social medias, AJ Bate, Instagram and Facebook. And it's Jason A. Comedy on Facebook and Instagram. And thank you so much, guys. We'll check you out next week. We appreciate it.